Welcome to another edition of the Untold Patriots Stories podcast with Scott Prusak and Dave Usher, where you'll hear stories told by the players and media members.
Good evening, everyone. Welcome to another edition of Untold Patriot Stories. This is Scott Prusak along with Dave Usher. Our guest tonight is an award-winning columnist and writer for the Boston Globe and a returning guest, Christopher Price. How you doing, Chris?
I'm doing well. How you doing?
I'm doing all right. So, Dave, you can get it started, and we'll start talking some current Pats info.
Yeah, I'm a little scared because you can see the smile on Scott's face. The negativity is flowing through him. He has fully embraced the dark side. So let me start off with something more positive and fun. Pro Football Hall of Fame recently put out their 25 semifinalists for the 2024 class. Rodney Harrison and Vince Wilfork were part of that, as well as James Harrison and Fred Taylor, who had a cup of coffee with the Patriots. And a couple guys I'm not going to mention that were on the practice squad and didn't play a game. But far as Harrison and Wilfork go, I'd love to hear your case for them. I know a lot of times it's writers that have to pitch it. So what are your thoughts? I know you wrote an article over the summer about Wilfork. If you can just reiterate some of that, I'd appreciate it.
Yeah, yeah. I think I love the idea of Wilfork going in the hall. I talked to 10 or 11 voters. And they all were surprisingly optimistic. And a number of them said that they would vote for him, including John McClain from Houston, said they'd vote for him immediately. That being said, I still think he needs a strong advocate in the room. Mm-hmm. Someone who saw him on a regular basis, someone who saw him play on a regular basis. Because nose tackles are historically frowned upon when it comes to the Pro Football Hall of Fame. And honestly, defensive tackles as a whole, if you're not a sack guy, if you were just kind of a gap, a space eating monster like Vince was, they don't really look at the numbers. And so, you have to be a Warren Sapp type to be able to get their attention. Vince wasn't that kind of guy, but all Vince did was anchor one of the best defenses for over a decade in New England. I think he deserves a spot. I think he deserves at the very least to be a part of the conversation. I love the guy. I'm a Vince Wilfork and probably a Rodney Harrison apologist. So I don't know. I'm probably biased in that because I got a chance to see them play every day. Oh. But I would be relatively optimistic about at least Vince's chances when it comes to the Hall of Fame.
I think the main difference there is I think Vince is universally liked. He's a very fun guy. He's a jovial person, whereas Rodney was very intense.
Yeah.
And, he played the game, in my opinion, the way it was supposed to be played, but some people didn't see it that way. Some of his own teammates at times.
Yes. Unapologetic was Rodney's approach. I loved watching Rodney play. I thought it was an honor to get a chance to cover him on a regular basis. He was one of my favorite guys for a number of reasons, not the least of which is you could talk to him about the game and he would always be straight with you. You weren't always going to get the truth. Let's say that, but he would just say, look, I'm not going to tell you that. I can't tell you that that's part of the game plan. I can't reveal that, but I was able to on a number of occasions put my tape recorder away, put my notepad away and say, look, help me become a better reporter here. Help me understand what I'm watching, what you guys are trying to do. And so that was one of the reasons why I loved Rodney. Also, Rodney, like I said, he was unapologetic in the way he played. He didn't curry favor with teammates. He didn't curry favor with opponents. He was who he was. And if you didn't like him, well, that was too bad. And so, look, again, like I said before, I'm a Vince apologist. I'm a Rodney apologist. I think both of them deserve to be in the Hall of Fame. I think right now, probably Vince has a better chance, but it is what it is, unfortunately. I think Rodney is fairly secure in his legacy. I'd love to see him in Canton, but I think that right now, he's fairly secure in his legacy and what he has.
So we had you on, I think it was in the preseason. And the reason why I'm asking this, question is I don't think any of us would have thought that we would be going through what we're going through right now. So your ceiling was 11-6. So we can that ceiling's done.
That's a Sistine Chapel kind of a ceiling. That's way up there, right?
Yeah, and then your floor was 7-10, so they have to win 5 out of their next 6 to.
Yeah, I'll say this, Scott. It's interesting, and I remember us talking at the camp during training camp at the tent during training camp, and I was talking about this with my colleague Nicole Yang the other day. In the summer, they were competitive.
Yeah.
They were competitive. I remember going back and watching the joint practices with the Packers and going, this is a good football team. This is a team that's going to surprise some people. This is a team with a really strong, aggressive defense. The offense wasn't great. We knew the offense wasn't going to be great, but the defense was good. You figured the special teams had to be better than it was last year.
Yeah.
You know, and so you thought, okay, you know, things fall together for them. Everyone stays healthy. You know, they're going to challenge for a playoff spot. I don't know if anyone could have foreseen this. I just, again, defensively, I think they're competitive. I do. I think that they're a very competitive group on the defensive side of the ball. And that's even without Judon Gonzalez. Look, you take it with a grain of salt because it was the Colts and the Giants, but they're holding teams. They're making it winnable for the offense. In a normal world, if you hold the Colts and the Giants to 10 points each, you should win both those games, even if you have a triple-A offense, you know. But the offense has just been miserable this year. And I think, honestly, we can go down the list of reasons, but it starts with the offensive line,
right?
And the health of the offensive line and the fact that they swung and missed on guys, you know, Riley Reiff, Calvin Anderson, and they had to kind of make it up as they went along. You know, Cole Strange goes down, his first day in pads, goes down with a knee injury. Trent Brown has never been fully healthy all season long. Poor guy's had a bunch of injuries. You know, Michael Wenyu, he missed all the offseason because of the ankle. And look, I'm not making excuses, but I'm saying it's a domino effect, right? And we've seen it here in New England where a great offensive line can make an average offense good and a good offense great. And it just was bad from the jump this year, health-wise, you know, personnel decisions, and it just bleeds over into the rest of the offense. I'm not taking the onus off Mac, and we can get into Mac a little bit if you want to. So, I'm certainly not taking the onus off him, but it starts with an ineffective and unhealthy offensive line, and it kind of goes from there.
So do you think if you had a quarterback, and I heard it somewhere today, that if you had a quarterback that just put his hands on the wheel at 10-2, and just stayed in his lane, what do you think that their record would be right now?
They'd maybe be close to 500, around 500. You know, maybe 5-6. It's funny, Mac made the point earlier in the year that, you know, the two losses at the start of the season, the Eagles and the Dolphins, you know, they were 20 yards from winning both those games.
Right.
So they get a bounce. You know, if Cole Strange's, you know, lateral is ruled correctly, who knows what happens? If Kayshon Boutte gets both feet in bounds, who knows what happens, you know? The thing is, though, I mean, that's what bad teams do what ifs.
Right.
Over the course of my life. Bad teams do that. I think ultimately, John, Scott, I'm sorry to answer your question. I think that they would be probably around 500 if they had just a guy who wasn't making bad decisions, who wasn't trying to do too much, wasn't trying to throw into traffic, you know, kept his feet underneath him. They would probably be in the 500 or so range.
And I think that's the frustrating part, because if his interceptions weren't so egregious at the end of games, when they're in a position to either tie the game, win the game, I think that's what makes it stand out more than anything else.
Yeah, it really is. It's just, it's funny. I was joking about this with a reporter, is the idea of the ill-timed interception. There's never a good time for an interception, but it seems that the picks that he's thrown in all nine of these losses, you know, other than the two blowouts, other than the New Orleans game and the Dallas game.
Throw those out.
He has just chosen the worst possible time to turn the ball over. He really has. Even at the end of the Bills game, when they're coming down there at the end, and you're like, oh boy, is he going to, what's going to, you know, there's this foreboding sense of doom that he's going to, you know, he's going to find the wrong guy. But it's just a series of ill-timed turnovers. And the thing about Mac here, I don't know if you guys want to go to, but this is kind of the overriding thing with me and Mac Jones this year, is that as the quarterback, it's on you to be able to make the thing work, even when it's not all perfect, even when they're kind of falling down around you.
That's being a leader.
Yeah, exactly, Scott. You have to be a leader. You have to figure out a way to make it work, even when your offensive line is falling apart. If you don't have a running game, if you don't have reliable targets, you know, that's why you're on the cover of all the magazines. That's why you date the supermodels. That's why you get the big contracts. The quarterback is the guy who needs to be a leader, needs to be able to make things work when things aren't perfect. And I don't think Mac can do that.
Right.
I don't think he's capable of being the guy who lifts everyone up and kind of rally every, you know, my podcast partner, Chris Hogan, said, you know, for years and years, it was the quarterback, you know, rallying everyone. And now everyone has to rally the quarterback, you know, to be able to put him in a situation. It was the quarterback before who would be able to put the team in the situation. Now the team has to put the quarterback in the situation to make everything work.
Well, it's funny. I was just going to say that it's really magnified because he's the inverse of Brady, right? Because we always thought Brady would come through. You know, we never doubted him. He didn't always come through, but it seemed like he did. And it's hard to remember the times he didn't, but you're expecting the other shoe to drop when you're talking about Mac.
Yeah. Yeah. It really is. It's true that you're just waiting for it. You know, you're just in it. I feel that there's a ghastly kind of fascination, you know, the end of the Colts game. It was, you know, when he threw that ball, it's like, is it going to come? And you say, well, there it is. Yeah. You know, and I don't take any pleasure in saying that because in my experiences with him, he's a really nice guy. It's just he doesn't seem to be the kind of guy who can turn, you know, chicken, you know what, into chicken salad.
Right.
He doesn't have that gene in him as a quarterback. And so, you know, you say, what are you going to do?
So I had mentioned Brady briefly, and he's had some comments about the NFL in its mediocrity. And do you have any thoughts on that, or how do you feel is with his?
Yeah, it's interesting. I was going back because I saw Alex Smith say what he said on ESPN, and I think there's a little truth to both sides. I think, you know, I was joking with someone. I said I'm old enough to remember when, you know, the big knock on Brady was he was a system quarterback. You know, not an easy division. So the game has changed. You know, we talked about Rodney before. If Rodney was playing these days, he'd end up paying back half his salary in fines.
Yeah.
It's just the reality of the situation. You know, it's not, I'm going to sound like a, you know, old man, get off my lawn kind of moment. But the game is different. I mean, you guys were around for that era. It's just different. And I think that some of that can be mistaken for mediocrity or softness, or it's just the game has evolved to a point where you can't play like that consistently anymore, good or bad. I'm not saying it's, you know, it's good, bad. It's just the game has changed, and you see the successful teams, you know, evolve with the times as the Patriots did for such a long time. You know, you see the Chiefs doing it these days. You see the Eagles doing it these days, these teams that are kind of ahead of the trend. And that's how you succeed. But I guess really to kind of go back to your question, I think that, you know, there was, it's just the game is different now. It's just way different now than it was even when Brady, you know, broke in 20 years ago.
I think one of those big differences is how the preseason's treated now. I mean, I understand there's a lot of good reasons for keeping people healthy and keeping them on the field for actual games, but it's like the first four games of the season now are almost what I'd equate to preseason games, and people are getting up to speed, and that may be causing their its own injuries.
Yeah, yeah, and you know, it's a great point, and we can kind of go down this road. It's not just preseason; it's practices.
Yeah,
the amount of padded practice, the amount of hitting that you're allowed to do, and look, it's part of the DNA of the game. There's a level of violence. You have to callous your body up. Mm-hmm. If you want to succeed over a 17-game regular season, you have to hit and get hit and get used to that process. And so I don't want to go grumpy old man, but there's the idea that, you know, you need to have hitting. You need to hit on a regular basis, and maybe the league and the players have to find some sort of happy medium in all of that where you get to do more hitting, but, you know, maybe you take something off on the other end. So I know that obviously the focus is on player safety these days, and it should be. It should always be on player safety. Mm-hmm. But I do think that there needs to be some sort of middle ground when it comes to preparing a player for the action during the week whether it's, you know, practices or the preseason or the OTAs or whatever the case may be, I think we can all kind of strive to find a better happy medium and all that.
Totally agree.
So I guess the biggest story for the rest of the year isn't going to be the wins and the losses. It's going to be what's going to happen with Bill Belichick. Do you agree with that?
Yeah. Yeah.
So I'm amazed at what's going on right now. It almost seems in some ways that Belichick's either given up or is kind of maybe coaching his way to be fired, because he doesn't want to get, if he is leaving, he doesn't want to get traded, because if he gets traded, whatever team he's going to is going to have to give up draft picks. And we all know how he feels about draft picks, right?
Yeah.
But it does almost feel like he has one foot out the door and behind the scenes that there's something going on with Kraft and Belichick. There's no way you can say otherwise right now.
Yeah, I do think that there is a power struggle. And it's strange to say between a coach and an owner, but I mean, I think there is a power struggle going on there. And I think, Scott, ultimately what we're building toward here is a conversation between the coach and the owner at the end of the year, where the owner brings Bill in and says, look, he doesn't want to fire. I don't think Robert Kraft wants to be the guy who fires Bill Belichick. I'll say that. I think he brings the coach in at the end of the year and says, look, you need a GM. Because I still think he's a good X's and O's when he's given the players, when he has the players. I think he is a good X's and O's guy. I think that this is that conversation is the first conversation that will ultimately determine his future in New England. If Bill says, sure, let's come up with a GM, you know, I think I would be well served by working with someone, whether he's a contemporary or someone I know, someone of like mind, we can work together and the whole thing can move forward. I think if Bill says, I don't want a GM, that's the first conversation in a series of conversations that ends with him going somewhere else.
So a counterpoint to this, Chris, is isn't it almost getting to the point where he's pushing Kraft to fire him now? Because he's basically, I mean, we can say whatever we want about Mac Jones. He hasn't had a fair shot since he's been here, right? Mm-hmm. Right now, he's in his own head and he's a mess. And Belichick has benched him 5 times, started him the next game. He's pulled him out of games, and he's still the starter, right? So it's almost like Bill saying, okay, you know what, Robert? You wanted me to draft Mac Jones? He's going to be playing the rest of the year, and you're going to see what he is, right? So isn't it almost getting dangerously to the point that Kraft might have to do something? Because, I mean, this isn't going to get any better.
In that scenario, though, I think that Bill knows that Robert doesn't want to fire him. I think Robert wants, I don't think Robert wants to be the guy who, regardless of how many fingerprints he had in each move, be remembered as the guy who was at the wheel when the best football player of all time left and they didn't get anything. And the best coach of all time left and they got a second round draft. I don't think he wants to be that guy. I think it will be not a game of chicken, but it'll be like, look, you know, Bill, we want you to stay around, but we have these provisions that we want you to meet. You need to check off all these boxes if you're going to stay. If you don't agree to these, then Robert could spin it as a way to say, all right, look, we decided to make some changes, but Bill wasn't on board with these changes. So we're going to move forward without him. And whether that means, you know, he has to sit out a year before he goes somewhere to coach or, you know, the contract thing, or they end up trading him for draft picks, I don't think Robert wants to be remembered as the guy who lost Bill Belichick, even with the way this whole season has played out. I also think in the context of this conversation, it's important to note that I think Mac Jones is of the four quarterbacks they have there. I think Mac Jones is the best quarterback. So kind of take that for what it's worth.
You had a choke on saying that one.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah. I tried to be as dramatic as possible and wait to call. Yeah, I think Mac Jones is the best quarterback that they have on the roster right now. And so I think Bill can look himself in the mirror and say, I'm playing the best quarterback that we have. I think I'm giving us the best chance to win. Now, you can, of course, go back and make the argument that Bill was the guy at the switch when he was the guy who selected all of these quarterbacks. So, and that goes back to my conversation before about I think he's the best coach. I think he needs help as a GM.
So
he needs a personnel guy.
A couple of points on that because I'm with you. Just interestingly enough, with this sort of Kraft Belichick rift, if you will, Bill Yeo came out and said, there's a hierarchy here. You know, the owner makes the decisions. So I don't know if he was posturing in that, but that was an interesting point. And then the other part, like you said, I think Bill's GM grades have been subpar. And that might be overly fair. But as a coach, you know, I've talked to some folks about this, and if you put Bill Belichick in Miami, like everyone talks about what a genius McDaniel is there. But if you put Bill there with that talent, like you were saying, if you give Bill the talent, can he be successful with a talent like that? Or if he was in Buffalo, would they have a better record? I think it's absolutely yes.
Yeah.
To both of those.
Yeah, I agree. I would go further. I would say if Bill Belichick was on the market tomorrow, there would probably be a dozen teams who would have a contract emailed, faxed over to whatever, you know, whatever you wanted to, you know, faxed over immediately, who would want him as a coach. Now, the question is, again, is the GM question. Could he work with, look, I've floated a name. I have no idea if it would work, but I floated the name Louis Riddick out there before. Louis Riddick said he wanted to be a GM. He knows Bill. He played for Bill. You know, I think Louis Riddick, you know, by all accounts is a tremendously smart individual. Maybe Louis Riddick is the guy. You know, I don't think that the Monday after the last regular season game, Robert's going to call him into his office and say, all right, clean out your desk. You're done. I think it's a conversation, like I said, and it could be a series of conversations that ultimately leads to him leaving, but it also could be, it starts a series of conversations that would end with him, you know, them bringing in a general manager and all kind of moving forward together.
So you were saying, you were saying before you didn't want to sound like an old man, but then you just said facts. So I was giving you some slack before. Now, when you talk about faxes, I don't even know if my son knows what that is, but go ahead, Scott. I'm sorry.
No, carrier pigeon.
There you go.
Smoke signals.
So I guess, you know, like the whole Mac Jones thing right now, he is literally broken. I mean, beyond repair, right? So they've had after bringing Will Greer back to put on the practice squad, they've had 18 quarterback transactions since the beginning of the year. So the question I have, right, Chris, is if no matter what, Mac, you're going to stop Mac Jones week after week after week, what the heck is it with 18 quarterback transactions? I mean, bringing somebody in, cutting them, demoting them, signing them to a contract, putting them on the roster, putting them back down, and now like Will Greer again. Like, what is the point of all this?
It's a great question. And I think there are a lot of things at play. First off, you do have some roster flexibility with these guys. And so if you need to bring in someone like a Connor McDermott, you can cut Will Greer and bring him back. And, you know, you keep your fingers crossed that he doesn't sign somewhere else. And so it does, the fact that they do have guys, they can make a few moves. They can make some personnel moves that maybe they couldn't make with some other guys. But yeah, look, for me, this all goes back to October of, 2017, when they traded away Jimmy. They botched the dismount from Tom Brady in the worst possible way.
That's another.
There's no way around it. It goes back to that. The way, whether Bill wanted him to succeed, they would end up trading Tom or what, but they screwed up the succession plan. They did. The bill is, no pun intended, is coming due because they haven't been able to figure it out. You know, the Cam Newton 1 year experiment, you know, went about as well as I think it could have gone.
Well, they literally signed him in June, right?
Yeah. And look, in Mac's rookie year, I think Mac was good. Mac had a really good rookie. For a rookie, he had a good rookie year, but he wasn't able to build on that. And goes back to my theory that wherever Josh McDaniels ends up, that's where Mac should go, because Josh McDaniels was the only guy who was able to unlock Mac Jones over the course of a year, over the course of a season. So
it's like Skonecki and Trent Brown.
Yeah, exactly. They're just that's perfect. They're just coaches We all know it. We've seen, you know, we watch. They're just coach certain coaches who can get certain players for whatever reason. They just make it work, and you know, Mac and Josh, you know, have that connection. So I think it, for me, like I said, it all goes back to, I know we're kind of, you know, revisiting history here, but it all goes back to the way they handled the post-Brady era. They didn't handle it well at all. They didn't have a real plan, and now they're paying for it.
So you mentioned Will Grier, and I just, can you give me, can tell me what's going on there? I know he's had some personal issues, potentially some mental health stuff. I know that the Patriots liked him in the past. Is he potentially part of the future? Are they waiting out to see if he can get right? Or what are your thoughts?
Yeah, I think you could put both Will Grier and Malik Cunningham to some extent in the same category, and that they like them as developmental guys.
Okay.
They have them in the building for a year and they let them grow up in the system. I think it's too much to ask either one of them to do anything this year.
Okay.
I'll put it that way. I think that they like them long term. I think that they really like what Malik can do. Like that he can do different things. And you guys know, I mean, Bill loves that kind of stuff.
Yep.
I think they like Will Grier enough to want to keep him around more than just as a scout team or a third string guy that, you know, he's smart, he's conscientious, he's been around the game, he's played multiple offenses. I haven't heard anyone across the league say a bad word about him, you know, he's not going to be, you know, an MVP, but, you know, he's got a good reputation around the league. And I just think that he is a guy who he's going to be better off once he spends a full year, especially a full off season in the system and gets up to speed. And so look, if Bill, we don't know if Bill's going to be here in 2024. We don't even know if, you know, what's going to happen? What's going to be taking place around the corner? But I think it's reasonable to assume that if Bill is here and if the same hierarchy is in place, that Will Grier should be part of the conversation in 2024.
So, you know, Bill Belichick, you know, again, a couple of things. So in your mind, so the communication with the whole quarterback thing. So he stated back in, I think it was 2001, that, you know, no quarterback can be prepared taking half the snaps, right? So, you know, and then of course when he's asked that question, you know how, I don't have to tell you how he deals with the press. So, but, so they, you know, he says that, then he has them compete for a week. Then they ask him, well, you know, when did you tell the team who the quarterback was? And his answer is, I don't know. I mean, he knows everything down to the So at this point, is he doing what's good? Because his thing has always been, I'm going to do what's best for the team. In your mind right now, is Bill doing what's best for Bill, or is Bill doing what's best for the team?
I think there's more of doing what's best for Bill, but I don't even think that's the case right now. Yeah. Because it looks like, I mean, look, if they were, it was funny, I talked to another reporter today. If they do this when they're 7-4, for example, everyone's like, oh, it's Belichick again. Oh, you know, the master manipulator, you know, keeping opponents on his toes and stuff. When you're 2-9, it's just kind of sad.
Yeah.
You know, it's just like, okay, all right, fine. You're not going to tell us. And like the rest of the league, I think, kind of rolls its eyes at that. I don't think it helps anyone. I don't think it helps anyone. I asked Juju Smith-Schuster today, when you have uncertainty at the quarterback position, how does that impact you as a pass catcher? And he's like, it doesn't matter at all. But I have to believe that, you know, Mac throws a different ball than Bailey. Bailey throws a different ball than Will Grier. Will Grier throws a different ball than Malik Cunningham. You know, there are little things that you have to adjust to here and there that you like, that you don't like. So I guess he's probably doing it more for Bill at this point, but I don't even think that that's like part of the conversation. Again, I think if they were rolling toward the playoffs and we had this quarterback discussion going back and forth, and I think it'd be kind of a cute, charming little angle, you know, and Bill being Bill, but it doesn't help anyone. I really don't think it helps anyone.
But I think you hit it on the head when you said they're 2-9. I mean, it's the same thing. You can say the same thing about, you know, they could do certain things when they had Brady, right?
Yeah,
you're 2-9, like, and that's why I don't ever see in any scenario Bill being asked, you know, I want you to work with the GM, because Bill is stubborn and set in his ways. And just by the way he's handling everything this year, like he doesn't have a feel for the room, or he doesn't care about the feel for the room. It's one of those two. Because if you're 2-9, you should be showing a little bit of humility now.
Yeah. Yeah.
And doing things different. Yeah. Right?
And maybe, Scott, maybe he, behind the scenes, you know, maybe has a come to Jesus moment. You know, at the end of the year, or at some point, look, I was debating with someone, and I'd be curious to get your take on this. If last Sunday was rock bottom, because it felt like rock bottom for me. But and then I thought, if they lose at home to the Jets and Zach Wilson or Tim Boyle or whatever at the end of the year, then I think that's rock bottom. But Sunday felt like rock bottom in that it was a miserable day. You know, it was cold. Yeah. It was rainy. The way they lost, that I think was an embarrassment for Belichick, because he has so much history in that building, or at least in the Meadowlands. Maybe there's a come to Jesus moment in the future. I don't know who it's with or what sparks it, but maybe that's, you know, he's never going to be cuddly. He's never going to be warm and fuzzy and, you know, all that. But, you know, I have to imagine this year has changed him a little bit.
Well, I'll let Dave give his answer, but my answer would be, I do agree with you that it was rock bottom, but we have 6 more games left. And we've been saying every week it's rock bottom. And then every week they come out and it's worse than the week before. I mean, you got to remember, we got 6 games left. And they're playing some pretty good teams in these last 6 games.
Yeah.
You know, it's funny, you know, you mentioned Zach Wilson. I mean, I don't know. He's really the same as Mac Jones right now. But I would answer that with, yeah, I do think we've hit rock bottom, but I do think we can see worse.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, I guess
what is it? The Oakland in Moneyball?
Yeah.
You know, there's every team, then there's us. Then there's every other team, then there's a layer of, you know what, and then there's us.
Yeah.
You know, it feels like that's where we are at this point.
I mean, did you ever think we'd be the second worst team in the NFL?
No. I never thought that I would be bookmarking Tankathon in November.
Yep.
You know, yeah. I thought they'd be middle of the road, but I very quickly came to realize this is what everyone else in the National Football League has been dealing with the last 20 plus years.
Yeah.
There's a feeling every week, you don't know, you know, you just don't know. You roll the footballs out there and you say, well, you think that there's a game plan and you think they can win a few matchups here and there, and maybe they get a bounce and they get some special teams magic and possibly something happens. But no, I never thought that we would be talking about 2-9. Never.
Yeah, their days for special teams magic is gone. But but I'll say, you talk about rock bottom, to answer your question. One thing you missed about last week's game was rock bottom was Rob Gronkowski commenting on it. That was rough to watch. But yeah, it was tough. But I think rock bottom is going to be the Chiefs game. I think they're going to lose 54-3 at home, and that's just going to be the. I think they're going to have the worst defeat ever in Foxborough, because I think the Chiefs still want to rub it in on them.
Yeah.
And that's going to be really hard to watch on your home field.
Yeah. And maybe Andy Reid is the, because he loves Andy Reid. Maybe Andy Reid is the impetus for that. Hmm. The reinvention of Bill Belichick, and he just grabs him and says, look, what are you doing?
You know?
Speaking of Andy Reid, look, someone brought this up the other day. We can sit here and talk all the live long day about Belichick's pursuit of Don Shula, but the way Andy Reid and the Chiefs are going, they're going to eclipse Bill Belichick regardless in 5 years if Patrick Mahomes and Travis Kelce and Chris Jones, if they all stay healthy, you know.
Reid's a cheeseburger away from not coaching anymore.
Okay, funny. I talked to my friends in Kansas City, and I say, just enjoy it, man, because it ends like that.
It does.
All of a sudden, you know, you're looking back 3-4 years in the past, and you know you're 8-8, and you're just hoping to squeak into the postseason with a backup. You know, it goes by in a blink.
But the polar opposite of Belichick is Andy Reid, right? Because Andy Reid doesn't want to be that guy. Like, he's not, you know, I have to be in control of everything. He's happy with people around him. And if you ask Andy Reid, you know, and I think the people that are taking shots at Belichick now, because he's a wounded animal and everybody's, you know, piling in right now. But the difference between Belichick and Andy Reid is that if you ask Andy Reid why he's been so successful, the first thing he would say is Pat Mahomes. I mean, Pat Mahomes, right? Mm-hmm. If you ask Belichick why he's been so successful, it would be what? Bill Belichick.
Because of Bill Belichick.
Yeah. And that's why everybody's piling on the way they are. You know, and you even look at Philadelphia. Since they won the Super Bowl, they've had one losing season. They've made bad picks. They've done a lot of things, but they've made up for it by signing people. And then, you know, so you look at it. And I mean, unfortunately, a lot of the stuff, like you said, he's now reaping what he sowed. I mean, a lot of the decisions, it all comes back to him, you know, right now, what we're going through.
And I'm fascinated, Scott, to see if. I'm fascinated to see how they go about trying to rebuild it. I am, just from a team building angle, just if Belichick is even going to be the guy who puts it all together. Maybe it's someone else. Maybe it's the next generation. Maybe it's Gerard Mayo, who's the next head coach, and he does this instead of Belichick. This franchise is endlessly fascinating to me, in the way they go about their business, in the way they angle for success. I'm fascinated by Belichick. I'm fascinated by Kraft, the franchise, and what's next for him, for all of them. I really am.
That's an interesting point. I think through some of this, Scott's been calling for Belichick's head, and he's also been calling for a whole regrouping, meaning Robert should step down and Jonathan should take over. Have you heard any inklings for something like, do you think that's feasible?
No, not yet. Yeah. Not yet. I know that that's the end game. And I would be fascinated to see what that looks like. I know that Jonathan has a far different approach than his father does. His father's much more of a glad hander and a backslapper and a, hey, you know, fellow well-met kind of guy. Yep. I think Jonathan is very different in that approach, but then I think back to the way the old man was when he took over the job, and he was very much of a straight shooter, and he kind of grew into it. And I wonder if Jonathan is capable of the same sort of growth and the same sort of process of finding a balance, let's just say. That's what we're headed toward. I think that's what we're headed toward. I don't think that Robert's necessarily going to, you know, yield the team. I don't think we're going to see, you know, like you guys watch the show Succession.
Yeah.
Yeah, we're not going to see like a Logan Roy, you know, Kendall Roy, Jonathan Kraft kind of deal. I'm going to be fascinated to see how the son grows into the job as we continue along this timeline.
Okay. So I got two questions before I hand it over to Dave, and then we'll get this wrapped up. So the first one would be, Dave mentioned it, so I'm just going to piggyback on it. Do you think at this point, do we need to make a clean sweep of everything when you talk about, you know, starting this all over again? My belief would be you can't have, if Belichick either leaves or is asked to leave, you can't have any remnants of Bill Belichick in the building. It's sort of like Pete Carroll, right? When Pete Carroll got let go, they wanted to purge the organization of how he coached, even though he never had a losing season, but they wanted to purge of how he coached and then start all over again. I think at this point, that's what you need. There really can't be anybody left that has a tie to Belichick. It has to be somebody new coming in with a new GM, doesn't have any history with the team, all that stuff. So what are your thoughts on that? And then I'll have one more, and then I'll hand it over to Dave.
Yeah, if they go that approach, if they decide to either Belichick leaves or they is fired or whatever, I agree with you completely that you have to start all over again. I'm not talking about, you know, tearing it down to the studs, but – You have to take a hard look at your organization from a coaching perspective, from a front office perspective, what works, what doesn't work, and move forward from there. And I think that I think that there will be a few kind of holdovers. I think that the general, I don't think he will have his fingerprints on the organization anymore. Yeah. I will say this. I'm fascinated to see this. And I just tweeted this before we started talking tonight, guys. Let's say Bill is with another franchise, with another organization. By the time that the Tom Brady night, they have a Gillette
Oh, yeah.
does Bill come back? Like, if Bill's with the Chargers, let's say, does Bill come back? Does he want to be a part of it? Do they invite him? What kind of reception he get? That was my fixation earlier this evening.
My answer to that would be no.
See, my quick answer would be no, but he's such a historian.
Yeah.
That'd be a hard one to walk away from, especially where, the limelight would be on him a little bit because they made each other in a lot of ways.
So my last question would be, we all know and think that Kraft is a great businessman, right? So we can talk about football, we can talk about Bill Belichick, we can talk about Mac Jones, but at the end of the day, what's most important to Robert Kraft? So when you start to see empty seats, which you kind of saw at the last game, so you got whatever how many home games they have left, but now you're talking sponsors, you're talking losing money. The apathy is what an owner doesn't want to see happen, right? When people lose interest in the team. So I know you said that you don't see him firing Bill Belichick, but if we continue on this trajectory of week after week saying we've hit below, do you think there could be a point for the benefit of his business rather than the benefit of not wanting to fire him? Do you think that decision could be made?
I think there are two things that I want to make a point on this. I think, first of all, I think Robert Kraft cares about public perception more than we give him credit for in this instance. And again, I'll go back to what I was saying before. I don't think he wants to be the guy, the owner, that'll be the first paragraph of his legacy, that they won 6 Super Bowls, but he let the greatest quarterback of all time walk and he let the greatest coach of all time walk. The other thing is the next milestone that you want to keep an eye on are season ticket renewals. And I think that will go a long way. That comes up in like March, I think. And that will go a long way toward informing the ownership as to what direction, you talked about apathy, that people might have. And so, look, I know that that's not going to be the be-all and the end-all, but I know that there's a huge waiting list for season tickets. But if there's all of a sudden a huge, if let's say thousands of people cancel their season tickets this offseason, I don't think it's going to happen, but let's say thousands of people say, turn up at Gillette Stadium and say, I don't want to renew. I've had it with this team. I've had it with this franchise. I'm going to spend my money somewhere else. Then that gets the attention of ownership. Again, I don't think it's the financial bottom line. There's all sorts of other revenue streams you want to talk about, but that goes back to public perception. I don't think he wants to be perceived as the guy at the wheel of a team that's a losing team.
And no, as a writer, you've got to be preparing for stories all the time and such. You probably never had to in the past in November start to be thinking about the draft. But have you had a chance to think about it yet? Assuming they're probably in a top 4 position.
Oh yeah.
Do you like, anyone in particular? Do you think they're going quarterback, tackle, Marvin Harrison?
I, it's one of those three positions. I would think it would have to be one of those three positions. I speculate about the mental health of Caleb Williams probably a little too much these days. But then he goes and he makes a throw that only he can make out of the entire draft class. And I say, that guy's the next Patrick Mahomes. Yeah. And let's say if they have the number 2 pick and they take Caleb Williams and then they sign T. Higgins to a contract, first day of free agency. Mm-hmm. Are you going to tell me that people wouldn't be back on board with this team like that?
Yeah.
Like if they had that kind of juice coming out of free, they go into free agency with a big wad of cash and they spend it the right way. And then they get a quarterback or they get the next Randy Moss in Marvin Harrison Jr. That people wouldn't just all of a sudden be back on board. Yeah. I've watched a lot of Caleb Williams. I've watched a lot of Drake May. I've watched a lot of. I like Michael Penix. I like Michael Penix a lot.
He wasn't a lefty, I think people.
Yeah. I mean, statistically, he doesn't blow you away like Caleb Williams does, but he gets guys. And this is, I'm not a huge intangible guy, but he gets guys to play hard for him. guys on the Washington team want to make plays for him. He's a compelling guy that you're invested in, that, you know, these teammates, these guys love him. They want to play hard for him. I also think, too, that Bill might be a little bit intrigued at the idea of having a left-handed quarterback for the first time in his career. But yeah, but
he's going to take a long snapper with that pick.
Yes.
Yeah, somebody from Rutgers.
You know what's going to happen? Honestly, guys, we're sitting here joking about it. He's going to trade into the second round and take a guard, you know.
Yeah. Don't say that.
Yeah, and we're all going to be like, what are you
doing? Hopefully he's not in charge of the pick this year. Let's just leave it at that.
So my last question is, I'm going to try and bring this around to positive, but maybe your most difficult question of the night. Looking at this team so far, are there any positives? I mean, the ones I'll tell you that I've come up with so far have been Jelani Tavai, Peppers, and then maybe a resurgence of Stevenson lately. Is that, do you think the same way, or is there any other ones you can point to?
Yeah, I think you're spot on there. I did a piece a couple of weeks ago where it's like five guys who deserve better than 2-8. And it was Peppers, Tavai, Ramondre Stevenson. I think Kendrick Bourne might have been on the list, and Bryce Berger. Okay. Just guys, I mean, they're guys, and you could also go to, I mean, you look at, I mean, Judon's a hell of a player. You know, Christian Gonzalez is a great player. I think that there are building blocks here for this franchise from a personnel perspective. I think when he's healthy, is tremendous.
Chad Ryland didn't make that list?
Chad Ryland. I got to say this, too. This is the tough thing as a journalist. I love Ryland. Ryland's such a good kid.
Yeah.
I do. He's a huge baseball fan. I'm a huge baseball nerd. We talk about baseball all the time in the locker room. He's a huge Phillies fan. That was tough to see. That really was tough to see. I feel bad for him. But yeah, I mean, there are fundamental elements that you could still build around here and find some level of success. It's just a matter of identifying those guys, getting them under contract, and kind of moving forward.
So you don't think that was the Kraft hotline calling down to Chad?
Pull it left. Go wide left.
Shank it.
Go wide left. You know what's in play here. Come on.
Just a bit outside. So, Chris, I'll tell you, it's always great talking football with you, and I appreciate you coming on tonight. A little under the weather, but thank you for spending some time with us. So I know we had you on before, but this is your time to pub yourself, your books, where they can get your books, where they can find you, social media. The floor is yours.
Thanks, guys. My Twitter account is C Price Globe. That's C Price Globe. You can read my stuff in the Boston Globe newspaper or at bostonglobe.com. You can also find any one of these books here. This is my latest one, Bleeding Green, History of the Hartford Whalers. If you're a hockey fan, I've also written a bunch of books on the Patriots, including The Blueprint, Drive for Five, Complete Illustrated History of the Patriots. They make a great Christmas present, Father's Day present, Mother's Day present, anniversary present, whatever the case may be. And if you can find me, I'm not doing signings on a regular basis these days, but I still get a kick out of signing copies of my book. So they are still available at where finer books are sold.
All right, Dave, I don't think you have that Whalers book yet, do you?
I don't.
So we got to we both got to buy that book so we can have a sign that book too.
Exactly.
Yeah. All right. Well, Chris,
my last comment is, I've just been looking at it all day, and I've put a smile on my face that. What presidents are temporary, Wu-Tang is forever behind you. It's wonderful. Got to give you props. People can't see it at home, but it's wonderful.
Exactly. My wife did a tremendous job. My better half did a tremendous job furnishing my office here. So
yeah, it looks fantastic.
I've heard a thing for that.
But yeah, so like I said, Chris, it's always great talking to you. A lot of knowledge that we get from you, and we appreciate having you on. So, all right. So wait, before we end it, I'm gonna. We did a prediction before. I said it at the beginning of the podcast. So my question for you is, what is their final record? And then we can talk about it when camp starts again.
3-14.
All right, so they got one more win left.
I think they got one more in them.
Who are they going to be?
Let's say the Jets. Let's say they'll beat the Jets at home. Finish up the season. Everyone will be happy. They'll go into the offseason on a, you know, as much of an up note as you can go into the offseason on. They'll finish up with a win against the Jets, but they'll still be in the top. I'll predict this. They'll be in the top three.
All right. There you go. Well, Chris, have a good night. Get better. Go take some NyQuil and get rid of that cold.
Thanks
a lot. Take care, guys.
All right, Chris. Thanks.
Thanks for listening to Untold Patriot Stories with Scott Prusak and Dave Usher. Please follow us on whatever platform you download your podcasts, and be sure to tell your friends.